From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
This is no time to be precious about locating the exact individuals directly involved in this particular terrorist attack. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. That's syndicated columnist Ann Coulter. Unfortunately, her comments aren't unique.
Today, a discussion on how media pundits are beating a drumbeat of war, and a roundtable discussion on mobilizing for peace.
Citizens around the country have begun organizing for peace and against war, many of whom are part of the anti-globalization movement, seeing war and international financial institutions as linked.
All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As this broadcast goes on, Afghanistan's senior Islamic clinic clerics have begun a meeting in Kabul to decide whether to hand over Osama bin Laden. The United States has named him as the prime suspect in last week's suicide attacks. The U.S. has set a deadline of Thursday for the Taliban to hand over bin Laden. The spiritual head of the Taliban authorities in Afghanistan, Mullah Muhammad Omar, has told the clerics that the Saudi-born militant who's lived under their protection since 1996 will not be extradited without evidence. He said the U.S. allegations are a pretext to wage war on Afghanistan. And in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, about 5,000 people staged a demonstration to protest possible U.S. military action against Afghanistan. The protesters chanting, "America didn't hunt what you can't kill. Osama is our brother, and an attack on Afghanistan is an attack on Pakistan," attempted to march toward the U.S. consulate, but were turned away by police and soldiers. The demonstrators later burned an effigy of President Bush. The Bush administration announced a major expansion of its power to detain immigrants suspected of crimes, including new rules prompted by last week's attacks that would allow legal immigrants to be detained indefinitely during a national emergency. Citing the new powers, the Justice Department said it would continue to hold 75 immigrants arrested in connection with the attacks. Previously, the department faced a 24-hour deadline on whether to release detained immigrants or charge them with a crime or with violating the terms of their visa. And the airline industry, which has already indicated it'll lay off 44,000 people in the wake of last week's attacks, won assurances of billions of dollars in financial help from Congress and the Bush administration. But lawmakers said they had not settled on details of the package and suggested the aid would come with conditions. Israel has responded to intense U.S. and European pressure by agreeing to stop offensive military actions against the Palestinians, removing a potential obstacle to the creation of a U.S.-led international coalition against terrorism. Sharon's move came hours after Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, again said he'd issued instructions for a ceasefire and had forbidden Palestinian security officers to fire at Israeli soldiers, even in self-defense. And this news from the Wall Street Journal: U.S. officials said there is no evidence Iraq had a role in last Tuesday's attacks in the U.S. or that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein helped prime suspect Osama bin Laden. According to current and former U.S. intelligence authorities, Iraqi intelligence officials have met with bin Laden operatives at least two or three times since the late 90s, including one meeting in 98 in Turkey. There's also some evidence that Iraq may have provided some financial assistance as well as small arms to al-Qaeda, bin Laden's organization, but few U.S. officials believe that any real alliance between Iraq and al-Qaeda ever emerged. Yesterday, Saddam Hussein said the U.S. was using the attacks on New York and Washington as a pretext to settle old scores. In related news, British Tornado warplanes bombed a southern Iraqi anti-aircraft missile site yesterday. And this news from the Wall Street Journal: in the days since the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York and Pentagon, the U.S. Senate has passed a bill allowing enhanced police wiretap powers and more widespread use of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Carnivore Internet surveillance system. The number of businesses conducting criminal background checks on employees has shot up. Congress is pushing more now to ban encryption products legitimately used to protect business secrets, but also available as a tool by terrorists and other lawbreakers. The Christian Science Monitor goes on to say calls for racial and ethnic profiling in the name of domestic security are also increasing, as well as legislative proposals that would make it easier for government agencies to keep secrets. And there's likely to be expanded use of face recognition software to scan everyday crowds for suspected criminals. Attorney General John Ashcroft says he wants to make it easier to detain foreigners, to wiretap phones, and to track money laundering. An ABC Washington Post poll last week showed that 66% of Americans would give up some civil liberties to fight terrorism. The latest New York Times CBS poll puts the figure at 74%.
And crack in the ghettos of LA, while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called the carnivore, while the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor. They're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for a Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crime? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? One in three adult Americans cannot read or write, and their children go to bed hungry every night. 2 million U.S. citizens are rotting behind bars, and while they're there, they're working hard, building parts for cars. The Army's running torture schools to keep the earth under control, and they're relocating Navajo so they can mine some extra coal. Our taxes pay McDonald's to sell tumors in Shanghai, while 100,000 poisoned vets are just about to die. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crime? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? People are resisting wherever you may go, and this is the single biggest fact they don't want you to know. From New Delhi to New Mexico, there are battles going on, and the darkest hour is just before the dawn. In Berkeley and New York, they're raiding radio stations, trying to turn the voice of the people into the voice of the corporations. Will we seize the airwaves, wipe the sweat off of our brow, stand and face the beast and shout democracy now? Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? That we're living in these times? That we're living in these times?
Who will tell the people? David Rovics, our resident musician, during this two-hour special of Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, as we broadcast from Ground Zero, just outside the area that used to be the World Trade Center, as more than 1,000 emergency workers, medical technicians, fire department, and police continue to comb through the area to try to save someone. But the prospects of finding someone alive are increasingly dim. The figures now believed to be more than 5,400 people lost their lives in last week's attacks. In the wake of this devastation, both the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, most commentators and editors focused on one theme, violent revenge. Here are a few selections. Syndicated columnist Ann Coulter wrote in the New York Daily News the day after the attack, quote, "This is no time to be precious about locating the exact individuals directly involved in this particular terrorist attack. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. We weren't punctilious about locating and punishing only Hitler and his top officers. We carpet bombed German cities. We killed civilians. That's war, and this is war." End quote. The same day, Steve Dunleavy wrote in the New York Post, quote, "The response to this unimaginable 21st century Pearl Harbor should be as simple as it is swift. Kill the bastards. A gunshot between the eyes. Blow them to smithereens. Poison them if you have to. As for cities or countries that host these worms, bomb them into basketball courts." End quote. Former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger said on CNN the day of the attack, quote, "There is only one way to begin to deal with people like this, and that is you have to kill some of them, even if they're not immediately directly involved in this thing," end quote. And in a letter to the Washington Post on September 13th, Rich Lowry, the editor of the National Review, wrote, "America roused to a righteous anger has always been a force for good. If we flatten part of Damascus or Tehran or whatever it takes, that's part of the solution." Well, the media, not only media, also amplifies the voices of pundits who call for war, but also citizens. Very few proponents of peace are given a forum on television or the newspapers. Right now, we're going to take a look at the media coverage of this devastating September 11th attack and the preparations for war, as well as the role the media plays, not only in this drumbeat, but in previous wars. We're joined on the telephone by Dan Hallin, professor of communications at University of California, San Diego, and author of The Uncensored War, The Media in Vietnam, and We Keep America on Top of the World, Television Journalism in the Public Sphere. And in our studio here at the Firehouse in Chinatown, New York, Janine Jackson joins us, program director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group, and co-host of the national radio program Counterspin. Welcome both to Democracy Now in Exile. Janine, let's start with you. An evaluation of the coverage we've been hearing over this last week.
Well, it's been very depressing, and it reminds us a lot of other military efforts we've seen. Unfortunately, those quotes that you just read are exemplary. We have pundits calling for war, calling for blood, and incoherently. I mean, if I can just add a little bit to the examples you gave, coherence is not necessarily uppermost with these folks. Another echo of the sort of bloodthirsty comments you gave was Wall Street Journal contributing editor Mark Halperin, who wrote a column in which he talked fondly about, remembered the U.S. reducing Berlin and Tokyo to rubble, but then went on to say that those who attack the United States are, quote, "not morally developed enough to comprehend the difference between civilians and combatants," close quote. So we have this not just bloodthirsty, but not even coherent drumbeat going on, mostly among pundits and commentators. News reporters, on the other hand, have done a slightly better job. Their sins are mainly sins of omission. They are leaving out the absolutely crucially relevant information about the U.S. role in cultivating bin Laden and the Taliban, the U.S. role in the region generally. They're leaving out international law, some of these things that people are calling for wildly as possible policy responses are simply violations of the law. If media are trying to have a discussion, as they claim, about why do they hate us? You know, what are the causes of anti-American sentiment around the world? You would think it would be a a minimal requirement of such a conversation that when people, politicians, pundits, whomever, call for responses that are violations of law, that media would point that out. So there's some distinction to be made between news reporters and pundits, with the pundits being really off the beam, like those quotes that you mentioned. News reporters are making different kinds of mistakes, but are still rallying around the flag, providing that kind of uncritical coverage, which looks like patriotism, but really does not serve the citizens.
Dan Helen, what about the people who are being chosen to be on television? I mean, I don't know what the financial arrangements are at this point. The hiring of retired generals to give the sort of blow-by-blow or the evaluation of the technical capabilities and then ask their opinions about whether we should be going to war or not, and who is not put on the payroll but just interviewed. But can you go into that choice of pundits?
Yeah, it's the same pattern that we saw during the Gulf War, which is that all of the networks feel that they have to have retired military officers or Defense Department officials to analyze things. And, you know, the most obvious thing is that nobody's hiring a specialist on Middle East politics, right, as a consultant. It's all generals. I think it's very clear that the generals are not only that they've hired as consultants are not only assuming that a war will take place and preparing to analyze it as sort of a technical thing, but in some ways really campaigning. And the first one that I saw, I don't remember his name, he was working for CBS, and he was really campaigning for an increase in the military budget, you know, saying that we didn't have enough resources to cover this. And it definitely distorts the kind of coverage that we get. In general, you know, I think that the most obvious thing to say is that there hasn't really been at all an attempt to seriously discuss what are the causes of this thing ultimately, and what should be the U.S. response to it. And the response is, to some extent, really assumed, and that we're now talking about the the sort of technical side of the preparations for it, and so on.
You know, it's interesting who is chosen to speak and how they're identified. I mean, in the period leading up to September 11th, 9/11, the big attacks, we were reading headlines about new information implicating Henry Kissinger and former CIA Director Richard Helms in the coup in Chile that led to thousands of Chilean deaths, as well as other people who were killed who were not Chilean citizens with the fall of with Allende and the rise of Pinochet. Now we see Kissinger speaking on a regular basis on television, Helms speaking, Oliver North speaking as an expert on terrorism. Janine Jackson.
Well, it just goes to show, you know, who we often hear about the liberal media. Let's hope we never have to have that conversation again, because here we are in a real international policy, you know, crisis situation, and peace activists, where are they? You know, people who are opposed to military intervention as a first recourse, they're not there. Instead, we're getting sitting and former military officials who, as you rightly point out, ought themselves to be questioned about their own involvement in possible war crimes, instead coming forth as the experts on the possible war crimes of others. It's surreal, and it is very reminiscent, as Dan Hallin said, of the Gulf War, where we remember that at one point television interviewed more Super Bowl playing, you know, football players about their feelings about the war than peace activists. This is narrowing the debate so that, as Dan pointed out, we're only having a discussion about what kind of war to have. The voices, and they're out there because I'm hearing them and you're hearing them, the voices that are saying, wait a minute, let's figure out how to respond to this. I actually have felt very hopeful from the conversations I've hearing. I feel like the public is ready to talk about how to respond without going to war against innocent civilians. I feel like we're ready to have that conversation, but we're not having it in the mainstream media.
Dan Hallin, professor of communications at the University of California, San Diego, author of We Keep America on Top of the World, Television Journalism in the Public Sphere. Let's go back to the other wars and how they have been covered and how the media has been controlled, and compare what we're seeing right now.
Well, what happens during wartime is almost always that the media lose their independence to a large extent. The paradigm case is really World War II, where it was assumed that there was a consensus on the war, and, you know, there was a total mobilization of society for war, and that included the media. And it wasn't really so much that the media were controlled by some outside force as that the media were, you know, voluntarily participated in that national war effort. And what's happened really is that that model has been carried over. And even in later wars, which have been much more controversial, have been limited wars, the media have felt a lot of pressure to go along with that. And I think that, you know, the pressures come from many places, but I would say really at the deepest level that it comes from the fact that this view of war is really deeply rooted in our culture. And the journalists themselves personally share it to a large extent. And also they really worry about the public reaction if they deviate from that. And they feel and on the other side of it, I think that they feel it's a very appealing thing to them. You know, people sometimes say, well, journalists always like to cover bad news and controversy and so on, but that's absolutely not true. Journalists love nothing more than a kind of feel-good, unifying event, and this patriotic reaction of the public to an international crisis is a prime example of that. One thing that I think is really significant in the Gulf War is that it was the promotions department of television stations that was particularly involved in organizing all of the kind of yellow ribbon events that news organizations were involved in, right, that they would actually participate in.
Janine, would you like to amplify on that?
Well, it also, I think, underscores in this time something about concentration of ownership that we talk about all the time. If you think about it, think how hard it is for journalists to really be independent. Say you're in a town working for a paper, and say you're in Baltimore and the television station WBFF has demanded of you, this is reality now, has demanded that on-air anchors read statements of support for Bush's plan against terrorism. They're given scripts, on-air anchors, news reporters, even a weather forecaster. They have to read that they personally support Bush and his efforts against terrorism. Say you're an independent-minded reporter and you're fed up with that. You don't want to do that. You've got no place else to go if the same company that owns that newspaper also owns the TV station or also owns the other newspaper in town. This is really bringing home the concerns about media for many people and the lack of independent or relative lack of independent and critical media that we have in this country. When is it more clear than now when you're desperate for information that is not simply feel-good information, that is not simply hearing America the Beautiful again? We need to feel solidarity, but we also are hungry for real information. And, you know, just the flags and banners is not doing that for us. And I think this really underscores the importance of alternative media outlets and the ones that we've got.
I had the chance to interview Frank Sesno or question him briefly about the media's coverage in times of war, for example, in the bombing of Iraq, and why they put retired generals on the payroll and not peace activists. And he said, we have discussed that, and we consider generals analysts and peace activists advocates.
Interesting. I mean, I would have no trouble indicating, you know, defining a general as also an advocate of a particular view of policy. And the peace activists that I know are also analysts, also have an analysis and have an understanding of the issues that they're talking about.
Speaking of analysis, by the way, I encourage people to tune in Friday on Democracy Now! We'll be speaking with Noam Chomsky. Also this week, we'll be talking with Edward Said about what is happening today. Finally, Janine Jackson, you're a media activist organization. What are you encouraging people to do since the media is the one, speaking of Chomsky, that manufactures consensus, possibly the most important in the way the media works these days, advance troops for any army?
I would say three things. One is, as always, talk back to the mainstream media. Let them know when they're saying America is hungry for blood, for example. Call them up immediately. Let them know they are not speaking for you. Secondly, I would say seek out and support those alternative and independent media outlets that we have. We need them now more than ever, and we recognize that. And then third, this is a conversation that doesn't have to go through the media. Like I said, I think people are ready to talk about a response to terrorism that does not involve going to war against innocent civilians. If mainstream media aren't going to be the place to have that conversation, we need to have it amongst ourselves.
Janine Jackson, I want to thank you very much for being with us from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It's fair.org. And I want to thank you very much to Dan Hallin, Professor of Communications, University of California, San Diego. We keep America on top of the world, television journalism, and the public sphere. You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile, Ground Zero Radio. Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. And thank you to David Rovics, who is live, not on Memorex, for the musical interludes. Well, today we're going to talk about peace organizing. The Prime Minister of Australia, by the way, has said today that Australia will provide troops to support any U.S. military action. And Japan is considering enacting a new law that would broaden its forces' responsibilities in overseas conflicts to allow it to contribute more. The Prime Minister insisted that Japan will not change its pacifist constitution, that any legal revision will not involve putting Japanese soldiers on the battlefield. Article 9 of Japan's constitution bans the use of force as a means of settling international conflicts and prohibits the country from sending troops overseas. Today we're going to talk about peace activism here at home. As the country prepares for war, activists around the country are beginning to discuss plans for peace because of the September 11th attacks. The IMF and World Bank have indefinitely postponed their planned late September meetings. Demonstrations planned against those meetings were expected to draw close to 100,000 protesters. Dozens of social justice and anti-globalization groups have been organizing the protests for months, and so have D.C. authorities, who had booked some 30,000 extra police forces for the weekend of September 30th. But even before the institutions officially announced their decision to cancel, most of the groups that had planned the protests pulled out of the demonstrations. The Mobilization for Global Justice, the umbrella group hosting the demonstrations, has postponed its call for nonviolent street demonstrations. The AFL-CIO, Unite, and Friends of the Earth, among other groups, have pulled out of the protests. The Ruckus Society canceled its action camp. But the International Action Center put out a new call to demonstrate at the end of the month, saying the U.S. response to last week's tragedy at the World Trade Center and Pentagon means more violence is to come. The IAC has refocused its call for protests. and has sparked a dialogue among organizers in D.C. and New York about anti-war efforts in the wake of national devastation. While some unions and environmental groups have withdrawn, many anti-globalization organizers are trying to draw in the efforts of that growing movement and to pull it into an anti-war effort. The Washington Peace Center is still going to hold demonstrations at the end of the month, and the Anti-Capitalist Convergence says it'll join with other groups in the streets of Washington to send a message about capitalism, against capitalism, and against war. Let's start with Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. What is your group doing?
Well, Amy, tens of thousands of people had planned to demonstrate in Washington on September 29th and 30th. Against the IMF, World Bank, against the reactionary Bush program. And in light of this crisis, this drive toward war, and the enormous escalation in racist attacks on Arab, Muslim, Sikh peoples, and many other peoples, we feel that it's essential to refocus the attention, not to let go a mobilization which involves so many tens of thousands of people. So we've reached out to all of our organizing centers. We've gotten an incredible response. All of the centers that we were in touch with, which is more than 70 organizing centers around the country, overwhelmingly support this call to refocus and to call it as a demonstration with the theme, "War is not the answer. Arab and Muslim people are not the enemy." Now, the response to that from organizations, and it has opened a whole debate among, and we've gotten broad support from Latin American solidarity activists, from anti-war groups, from peace and justice groups. We've established a new coalition around this new focus for September 29th. And we also have permits for the demonstration in Washington on that day. So this is also important for people to know. The new coalition is called ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism.
Robert Weissman is on the line with us from Washington. He's with Mobilization for Global Justice. Your group has called off the mass protests. Why? In light of what the administration and Congress is doing, clearly massive preparations for war.
Well, the protests that we had planned, as you know, Amy, were focused on the IMF and the World Bank. We had spent a lot of time with hundreds of people here in Washington arriving at a very nuanced and particular position. We had hundreds of groups around the country that had endorsed our position. And it was clear to us that this was not an appropriate time to go forward with the demonstration focused on those issues, that people who care about affecting policies at the IMF and the bank needed to put things on hold, and that if we had gone ahead, we would have done probably more harm to the cause we're trying to push forward than benefit.
Do you see, though, the issues of, that are raised by the World Bank and the IMF as somehow dovetailing with the anti-war movement?
Well, I think any progressive person sees the links between all the issues we work on, and it's hard to say that anything that goes on in the world isn't connected and really in the context of corporate globalization. At the same time, we don't want to reduce every issue to one just of corporate globalization or reduce every issue to one of militarism. They do have distinct dynamics and distinct problems. And the coalitions that form around particular issues are going to have a lot of overlap, but they're not going to be identical. So there were people who and organizations that were part of the Mobilization for Global Justice who shared our agenda on World Bank IMF issues who don't necessarily share the views that many of us have on peace issues. And we have to honor the integrity of the coalition that we had fashioned. We also thought that it's really critical at this time for an effective peace movement, for groups that have historically worked on peace issues to be at the forefront, and groups that have very clearly laid out commitments to nonviolence to be at the forefront of the anti-war movement that we're going to need. And for a variety of reasons, we thought the mobilization had not positioned itself that way, that if we had just simply switched the focus, not only would we have really done damage to the coalition that we had formed and dishonored that in a way, but that we would have appeared publicly to be opportunistic and actually undermine the efforts of peace groups we'd like to see taking leadership on these set of questions.
Marina Citron is with us from Direct Action Network. I saw you over the weekend at the Brecht Forum, where people had come, hundreds of people representing different organizations, to talk about how to frame a response to what was going on in the midst of the devastation, particularly here in New York. It was just at around 11 o'clock last night at Union Square, where hundreds of people still are gathered with candles, pictures of their loved ones. There are photographs everywhere through the city of people saying, last seen, for example, on the 104th floor of the World Trade Center, please call this number. And it seemed that the agony of the room at the Brecht Forum was how to do your traditional anti-war protest organizing and also honor the dead and honor those who are still yet to be recovered. What is Direct Action Network doing?
The Direct Action Network has been involved in a number of pulling together, actually, at first a large coalition as well in downtown Manhattan that met, and there have been hundreds and hundreds of people who've been meeting, both at the Brecht Forum and at Charas, Black Radical Congress. There are people meeting all over the city to talk about a response, and there have been a number of vigils as well. The discussions in the Direct Action Network have been how we can both mourn the victims and oppose war, and also put out the message, which is where the anti-globalization movement was going, that another world is possible, and now it's more necessary than ever. So bringing that all together, and that there is a link between these institutions of global capital and war, and that they're coming from the same system around the world. So we're linking, a lot of us anyway, are seeing the issues as linked and are opposing war and still putting out a vision that another world is possible, and we have to organize toward that. So the people who are organizing against the WTO meeting in November, there were going to be demonstrations in New York and San Francisco. We're continuing to organize. It's going to look different, and we've been coordinating with each other, and more along the lines of we must organize an alternative and another world is possible, and showing that in the street in an optimistic way.
It seems that the targets of the September 11th attacks, the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, you could say, of capitalism and militarism, are the same targets of the protesters that were organizing for the World Bank IMF protests, but a very different strategy, because the protesters for the end of the month were always declaring that they were nonviolent. I want to bring Kevin Martin into the conversation, National Director of Peace Action, one of the largest peace groups in the country. Yesterday, you held a nationwide conference call on how to organize. What has your group decided to do?
Well, we have members all around the country, and first of all, on behalf of them, Amy, I just want to say, on behalf of Peace Action, how glad we are that you're continuing to broadcast in exile, as it were. The call the other night, we had over 30 people from around the country, literally from Oregon to Maine, talking about local efforts that are already underway across the country, teach-ins, vigils, media outreach, acts of solidarity with the Arab American community. And I was frankly inspired, because a lot of this had been done spontaneously, and it's a time when the decentralization of the peace movement, which sometimes has its downsides, really was shown to be a strength of our movement. I think I want to offer just a few things. Peace Action is going to be consulting with some of our colleagues that we work with in something called the National Coalition for Peace and Justice that came together around the Yugoslavia bombing. It includes groups like Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, American Friends Service Committee, Pax Christi, Fellowship of Reconciliation, and others, about whether we should call for some sort of joint national action, and indeed whether we should join with the Washington Peace Center, the IAC, or others in terms of actions in Washington coming up next weekend. But I think as important as that is, and as I see and hear people mobilized on an emergency basis to try to stop any bombing or retaliation by the United States, and also to try to stop acts of racism and backlash against the Arab American community, we in the peace movement need to understand that we are probably in for a long haul here. I hope I'm wrong, but my colleagues in Peace Action agree that we're looking at the United States girding up to a permanent war footing. $400 billion a year military budget starting next year. More money for both missile defense and, quote-unquote, anti-terrorism programs. More money for the intelligence agencies. Domestic spying by law enforcement. Shredding the Bill of Rights. In short, we're in for, I think, the greatest challenge to the peace movement since the Vietnam War. But I think, and not to be a cliche here, but I think that in crisis there often is opportunity. And I think there's opportunity for the peace movement to talk about the root causes of injustice in the world and looking at U.S. foreign policy around the world. And doesn't that help? Not that anything would excuse the attacks last week, but doesn't our foreign policy help breed the resentment around the world that leads to terrorism? So I think that as we mobilize in the near term to try to stop a war by the United States, which is extremely important, we understand that we need to be in this for the long haul with deeper analysis and the ability to really mobilize people, and I think we can do that.
Kevin Martin, National Director of Peace Action, Peace Action Education Fund, along with Sarah Flounders, International Action Center, Rob Weissman, Mobilization for Global Justice, Marina Citron, Direct Action Network, and we'll be joined by Maria Ramos of the Washington Peace Center as well when we come back. But we are now going to go to our break for stations to identify themselves and listen to a little more of David Rovics.
From Guatemala to Korea, to the tunnels beneath Hanoi, from Tulsa to El Chorillo, fat man to little boy. We fought them in Nicaragua and upon the Cuban shore. Killed Gaddafi's daughter, see what the fatwa's got in store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see?
David Rovics, our musician in residence at the Firehouse, as we are just blocks from Ground Zero, where the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman, bringing you the Democracy Now in Exile War and Peace Report, the two-hour specials we've been bringing you throughout the week on Pacifica Radio and affiliates, as well as WBIX.org and broadcasting at Channel 34, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as we bring together community media in all of its forms. Just before we go to Maria Ramos of the Washington Peace Center, David, I wanted to bring you into this discussion as a musician, as an artist, who sees these may be the most difficult, very serious times that we have known in a very long time. What are your plans?
To keep on singing. I think that I think the movement really needs a sense of community, and I think the role of artists, one of the main roles of artists in the movement, is to help foster that sense of community, especially when people are feeling isolated by the corporate media and all the flag waving and everything else going on. I think that's an important role that we can play, and a certain form of education. I mean, a way of trying to reach people through poetry that people can be often more receptive to. Those kinds of messages, I think.
Maria Ramos, coordinator with the Washington Peace Center, you are one of those who are part of the protests that will be in the streets. Can you talk about your center's decision at a time when some are pulling back and saying that it's inappropriate to be in the streets now with the massive number of casualties, especially in New York, also in Washington? what did the Washington Peace Center base their decision on?
I should say, Amy, that we were not calling for a demonstration for the end of the month. They were not calling for people to take to the streets. Like Rob said, the mobilization for global justice has pulled out for that reason because they found that inappropriate, and we do as well. What we have been doing is holding a number of community meetings with people of conscience. We're calling for local action, yes, with an eye to the national and the international. Like Evan said, I believe that we're in this for the long haul, and we must think of building a campaign with short-term, long-term goals. We held a peace procession last Friday. Over 500 people came on last minute notice. We're holding another community meeting this Saturday to plan for events for Sunday. We need to discuss the short, we need to discuss the root causes of this as well, but with appropriate timing. So what we are doing is providing space for people to share their feelings and their emotions. People all across the world have been witnessing these kind of violent attacks, but this is new to Americans, and so we must respect that as well, but also building a campaign against violence for social justice.
Do you think taking to the streets would be damaging?
Right now, I think it would be inappropriate.
And yet you have the administration very much announcing their plans to go to war and very much in a revved up high alert mode.
Yes. Now, I don't think that we should scale back in terms of building a campaign. I think we need to do that. But I think demonstrating in the usual way of taking to the streets at now would not be appropriate again at this time. Organizing and building and meeting short-term, long-term goals, yes. But street actions right now, I at least for the Washington Peace Center and for others, is not what we're calling for right now.
Amy, could I jump in?
Yes. Rob Weiss. Is this Kevin or Rob Weissman?
It's Rob.
Rob.
I want to be clear about what the mobilization's position was, which is that it was inappropriate for us to go forward with the plans that we had made focused on the IMF and the World Bank, that was not an issue that was ripe for discussion right now, and that the character of the actions we had been discussing, especially around issues unrelated to war, was inappropriate. We also thought that it didn't make sense for us to transform what we had been doing into an anti-war action. That was not a declaration that we thought it was inappropriate for anyone or even the same individuals to engage in street demonstrations on anti-war issues. We just didn't think that we organizationally were the right place to be launching that.
Amy, if I could jump in here.
Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center.
I think this is a situation where we all want to take the time to mourn the thousands who were killed, but to caution, to wait, is a disastrously dangerous proposition because many, many thousands more will die in a new war, both around the world and here. And it impels us to find it immediately, new forms for people to mobilize and mobilize quickly. Now, next weekend in D.C., thousands, many 100,000 people plan to be in Washington, and thousands of people are already involved in reshaping that into a new coalition called ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. There also will be demonstrations in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, and throughout Europe. We're in touch with groups all over Europe who are mobilizing because this is a U.S.-NATO war. They feel it's an attack on many, many countries. And together, at least as a first step, a powerful response in Washington, D.C. on September 29th will begin a mobilization which must go forward from there and go forward with great urgency, linking the war and what it will do in countries all over the world. They're talking about ending states. They're not limiting themselves only to the Middle East. Every country that the U.S. has targeted in the past is altogether suddenly on the hit list, from Cuba to North Korea to all over the Middle East. So that makes it incumbent on us to think together, to think collectively, and to think quickly. Now, here in New York, there are demonstrations this coming Saturday and Sunday, Union Square on Saturday, extremely important. This is true all around the country. There are actions this coming weekend. But the following Saturday, a national demonstration in D.C. is the beginning of an extremely important process, and we can really go forward with strength. Just to mention that Bishop Gumbelton, Lucius Walker, Nicaragua Network, Mexico, the Mexico Network, the National Lawyers Guild, many, many other organizations that work on Korea, that work on Cuba. The Anti-Capitalist Convergence met last night in D.C., and they're also very much for going forward. There are meetings of hundreds of people at Charas, at
which
the IAC.
Which is a Lower East Side Community Center in New York.
And but here in New York at the IAC, there have been actually several meetings of more than 100 people. Well, so there's a lot happening on this. Everyone feels a ferment.
Let me ask Marina Citron, Direct Action Network, the different forms that protest is taking around the country.
Yeah, I think it's actually really, really significant because there are larger organizations or organizations calling for a large action. But what's been going on that I find so inspiring is that in hundreds of places, right, and I know personally of dozens of cities where there have been spontaneous vigils for peace and against war. So they're on campuses, they've been all over New York, that people are coming together, and the tone that people are setting themselves is one of both mourning and saying we need to have peace and to change things. So the tone is already being set by activists, and it's as of now not one of marching and demanding, but one of mourning and vigiling for peace. Something that I think is also really significant and we're working on in New York is because there's so many groups organizing, which is so inspiring, that it's not one or two coalitions, but it's dozens and dozens of groups of hundreds of people meeting, is to try to create a network that reflects that around the city so that people can work together and be empowered and have as much democracy as possible in working in issue areas, so that people who are working to defend communities have representatives from all of these different groups meet and then bring that back to the communities they're working in and so forth. There's also been dozens and dozens of teams since this happened that have been going out into different communities to just dialogue with folks in the community and dialogue about peace to counter what the media has been saying.
Undoubtedly, there is going to be a very serious crackdown on the protesters. And I wanted to ask Kevin Martin of Peace Action, with all that we're reading about civil liberties being suspended, these kinds of approaches in times of war can most often impact on dissidents and peace activists. How will you deal with this? We're hearing about, you know, increased wiretapping, people can be picked up, and secret evidence, immigrants deported. Kevin Martin of Peace Action.
I expect all that and worse if they are serious, and I believe they are, about gearing up for a, you know, permanent war footing in this country. I think Maria could probably talk about this better than anyone else. I was in Boston doing a few days of work, and I was stranded there for a few days. I couldn't get back to Washington. But I talked to our staff in D.C., and they were very shaken up. Our office is in downtown D.C., near the White House, near the State Department. And people on my staff were talking about it being unnerving to be in a police state. There were Humvees and armed National Guard members on every other street corner in downtown Washington. I think that atmosphere undoubtedly plays on the decisions of some groups to say now is not the time to be in the streets. I think what's important, though, is that we have respectful discussions like we're doing today about a variety of tactics. Peace Action hasn't made a decision yet whether we are going to endorse and have people in the streets at these various demonstrations that will be happening in Washington. I personally haven't made up my mind what I think we should do. One part of me says, yes, we ought to be in the streets in Washington, in the national capital. Another part of me says what we're doing around the country is just as important, if not more important. And I just hope that there's a sense of mutual respect among all the groups for whatever tactics different folks adopt. I want to just make one other quick point, which is that at the grassroots level, you have a lot less separation between environmental activists, human rights activists, peace activists, anti-globalization activists. And so I think that some of these discussions that folks have at the national level are just about moot at the local level, that you know, peace and justice activists, speaking very generally, at the grassroots level work together and will be working together to build a movement in this very difficult period at the grassroots level. And for a lot of those folks, whether or not they come to Washington is not going to be a big decision.
What about that issue, Maria Ramos, of the crackdown, particularly on immigrants? Dozens have been rounded up at this point and talking about the possible deportations of people without presenting evidence, etc.
Well, I've been talking to a number of leaders of different Latino groups around here, and people are, especially the Latino community, they're nervous. But they're also supportive of the victims. And they're supportive of some of the things that President Bush is saying, but they are nervous.
I'm looking at a letter that's been going around the internet that was submitted to the New York Times by Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez about their son Greg, and it's called "Not in Our Son's Name." And they say that we see our hurt and anger reflected among everybody we meet. We cannot pay attention to the daily flow of news about this disaster. They said our son Greg is among the many missing from the World Trade Center attack. Since we first heard the news, we've shared moments of grief, comfort, hope, despair, fond memories with his wife, the two families, our friends and neighbors. And they go on to say that we read enough of the news to sense that our government is heading in the direction of violent revenge, with the prospect of sons, daughters, parents, friends, and distant lands dying, suffering, and nursing further grievances against us. It is not the way to go. It will not avenge our son's death, not in our son's name. And we're hearing that a lot on the ground in New York near the World Trade Center. I think what we're seeing in the media does not reflect the sentiment of people who are carrying their photographs of loved ones around and are gathering in places like Union Square. There is not that bloodlust or that sense of revenge. As we wrap up the program, I just want to give people contact information. First of all, you can go to webactive.com, our website that airs Democracy Now! in Exile, and you can see everyone's contact information. You can also see this program at freespeech.org, and you can listen to wbix.org. That is WBAI in Exile. Very quickly, email. We only have 30 seconds. David Rovics, your website.
DavidRovics.com.
Sarah Flounders, your website?
IACenter.org.
And Marina Citron.
It's a call in number for things that are taking place in New York, which is 212-726-3272. That's by both coalitions.
As well, Kevin Martin, Peace Action.
Peace-action.org.
And Marie Ortiz. Maria Ramos, sorry, coordinator of the Washington Peace Center.
WashingtonPeaceCenter.org.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. This is only the beginning, just a glimpse of the dialogue that we will continue as people grieve and people organize against war. Robert Weissman, your email or website?
GlobalizeThis.org.
GlobalizeThis.org, and that does it. For today's program, our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer, Errol Maitland at BIX.org. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Karen Renucci, Hoi No, and John Alpert, Keiko Suno of Downtown Community Television. Thank you to Pacifica stations KPFA and affiliate KFCF, and of course, affiliate stations around the country. We are Pacifica. In New York, you can see us at Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel 34, Public Access Television. You can watch us at freespeech.org. We're in the historic firehouse of Engine 31. And by the way, today at 2 o'clock, the Pacifica National Board will be meeting by telephone. You can hear it online at wbix.org. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, and with David Rovics, our live musician in the studio, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.